Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Amel Cara, director of the Mitochondrial Disease Program at Mass General Hospital in Boston, will join us to discuss at the crossroad of mitochondrial disease and mitochondrial dysfunction. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. If you're calling in via phone, feel free to submit your questions to us by email at info@mitoaction.org, and we will do our best to get through as many questions as possible at the end of today's presentation. I think many of us have struggled with these questions at some point. Why are mito patients sometimes diagnosed with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and Lyme disease? Where are the overlaps? How do I know if I have mito, and are there red flags that should lead me to consider further testing? Dr. Amel Cara is joining us today to dive deep with us and explore some of these difficult questions. Dr. Amel Cara is an internist and clinical geneticist by training and currently the director of mitochondrial disease program at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She's the recipient of the 2013 United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation Fellowship, and Dr. Cara is overseeing clinical care, conducting clinical research and trials for mitochondrial disease patients. She is the immediate past president of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, chair of the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, and is part of the scientific and medical advisory boards of several different advocacy groups. Dr. Cara is also a founder and board member of the Mitochondrial Care Network, a U.S.-wide network overseeing expert centers for mitochondrial medicine, and the founder of Treat Mito, a clinical trial and research consortium for primary mitochondrial disease. Dr. Cara, we are thrilled to have you here today and can't thank you enough for everything that you do for our community and for taking time out of your busy schedule just to share with us and help us better understand the difference between mitochondrial disease and mitochondrial dysfunction and all that overlap.
Thank you, Stephanie, so much for that wonderful introduction. And I would like also to thank Kyra and MitoAction for the invitation today. I'm very excited to talk to you about mitochondrial diseases and dysfunction and answer some of the questions that you might have. So before I do that, allow me to share my screen. A few seconds here. So I will be looking on and off to the camera because I will be looking at my slides at the same time. So I apologize if I don't look directly at you. As you have heard, I'm an internist and a geneticist, so I do see mostly adult patients in my clinic, and I'm confronted in my clinic with all these questions that you might have about the chronic fatigue and the Lyme and what is the overlap. So I'm hoping that I could shed some light for you today. So I thought that we would start with a little bit of a background about mitochondria and mitochondrial diseases. And as many of you know, mitochondria is the organelle in the cell of the body that makes energy. When I ask the question, what does mitochondria do? In the classes that I teach, everyone screams, it's the powerhouse of the cell, which is true. So mitochondria does produce energy from the food that we eat, whether it's fat, proteins, or sugars. They get processed through these very complex machinery that is called biochemistry in our body. And then it gets broken down into very small molecules, which then enter the mitochondria. And the mitochondria, through something called the electron transport chain or the oxidative phosphorylation pathway, uses those molecules to create energy in the form of ATP, which is vital for our bodies and all of our cells to function properly. So mitochondrial diseases are really disorders of this energy production pathway. Patients with mitochondrial disease often lack that energy that would allow their organs to function properly. And because of that, and because energy is needed everywhere in the body, mitochondrial diseases can be very complex because they can affect anything in the body. And this is a quote that I took from the North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium, which is the National Institute of Health funded research and clinical registry that is curated by physicians across Canada and the United States, where we have now more than 2,000 patients entered. This is the definition that they use to describe what mitochondrial diseases are. And I found it very telling. So the challenge is the extraordinary clinical spectrum of mitochondrial diseases, which all too often leads practitioners to either underdiagnose them. So patients present with many symptoms and physicians are usually astonished. They don't know what's going on. So they're like, what is this complex disease? What could it be? And they may not know about mitochondrial disease. So this never comes under their radar. Or it's a condition that is overdiagnosed because this disorder is so complex that it must be really mitochondrial. And they get overdiagnosed and they over-refer patients for mitochondrial disease where, in fact, they don't have them. Really, this is really what encapsulates mitochondrial disease in our health system right now. It's either overdiagnosed or underdiagnosed. And we're going to go through the steps to understand why that is. So to understand that, we need to understand how young mitochondrial medicine is. So the very first time there was a publication, a scientific publication about a patient who was thought to have mitochondrial disease was in 1962. It was a young woman who was having failure to thrive and having high energy demand. And that was described by Dr. Luft in 1962. It was only a year later in 1963 where the first mitochondrial DNA was discovered. Before the 60s, we didn't even know that there was something called mitochondrial DNA. And it took 20 years from there for the first mitochondrial DNA mutation that was linked to human disease caused by defects in mitochondrial DNA to be described. And that was 1988 by Dr. Doug Wallace. And then it took another 10 years for scientists to discover that on top of mitochondrial DNA that can cause mitochondrial diseases, you could have a nuclear DNA defect that can also cause mitochondrial diseases. So as you can see, in the big scheme of the human race evolution, mitochondrial diseases are really, really young diseases. When you think about diseases, diabetes has been known since the Middle Ages. But this disease has only been really known since the late 80s. And so our knowledge, even though it has evolved tremendously since then, we still don't know a lot about mitochondrial diseases as much as we know about other very older diseases, much older diseases. And it's only been in the last 10 years where things have moved along a little bit more and we started having clinical trial. So you have to understand that sometimes when patients present to us, we don't have the answers because we still don't know much about this disease, even though we know a lot more than we did 10 years ago. And so because of that, and because when mitochondrial diseases were initially described, there wasn't much known about genetics back then. The initial diagnosis was really made based on the clinical presentation, meaning based on the symptoms that the patient presented with. And because it was so complex and the patient presented with so many different symptoms, experts have advised what we call a clinical criteria. Schedule to help physician and practitioners really think about mitochondrial disorders. So when they had a complex patient, they looked through this table here. These are called the Morava criteria that were advised in 2006, and which told doctors pretty much when to suspect mitochondrial disease. And as you can see here, there are different categories. So there's muscular presentation, central nervous system presentation, multisystem disease, metabolic blood tests and radiological tests and pathology on muscle biopsies. And for each of these symptoms, you get a point or two. And then if you look down here, if you scored one, then you were unlikely to have mitochondrial disease. If you scored between 2 and 4, you could possibly have a mitochondrial disease. And if you scored between 5 and 7, probably, and more between 8 and 12, definitely you had mitochondrial disease. But if you look closer to the symptoms, if you had migraine, which is a very common symptom in the general population, and you may have had some GI problems because you had gluten disease or IBS or something like that, you are already in the category of possible or probable mitochondrial disease. And because these things are so common in the general population, a lot of patients back in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s were diagnosed with mitochondrial disease based on these clinical criteria. So you didn't really need to have a lot going on to have that label put on your medical record, which was appropriate back then because this is what we knew. But things have changed in the meantime. And we learn more about genetic testing and about the genes, and our capabilities of doing genetic testing on a larger scale start to advance. So this graph, what it shows you is that the first gene was discovered in 1988. Back then, they were only looking at mitochondrial DNA. And then as they discovered more nuclear genes, which are presented here in orange, they started doing both mitochondrial DNA and nuclear gene testing. And then in 2010, we started doing these larger scale genetic testing called whole exome sequencing. And in recent years, the green part here is whole genome sequencing, which is even larger than whole exome sequencing. And as you see, we exponentially learned about genes, and we exponentially discovered genes. So we went from one gene in 1988 to now having hundreds and hundreds of genes that we know are directly linked to causing that mitochondrial disease. And so we went from doing diagnoses based on clinical presentation to now being able to confirm patient by doing genetic testing. And as we did that, as we learned more, and as we tested more and more patients that were clinically suspected of having mitochondrial diseases, we learned a lot more, and we learned very interesting things. One thing that we learned is that from all the patients who presented with a known diagnosis based on clinical criteria of mitochondrial disease, and this is a table in one of the publications we did, so these are the symptoms that patients presented with. So you have your dystonia, you have seizures, you have all these muscle-related issues. And then because of the genetic era, what we discovered is that these patients didn't have mitochondrial disease. They had other conditions that looked like they were mitochondrial, but they weren't. And so the list of these genes, this is not an exhaustive list, it's just meant to give an example to physician that it may look like mito, but it's not mito. So the list here includes other neurological problems, other neurodegenerative diseases, but it also includes things like viral infection and cystic fibrosis and diabetes, where it happens that this patient specifically here had diabetes and had a hereditary hearing loss. So you combine diabetes and hearing loss, which is very common in mitochondrial disease, but this patient didn't have mitochondrial disease. They just happened to have two different diseases at once, and combined, they were thought to be mitochondrial. So what this taught us is that even if somebody looks like they could have mitochondrial disease, they may not at all have a mitochondrial disease, which was very important because different conditions here have treatment that are associated with them. So if they never get the right diagnosis, they will never get the right treatment for their symptoms. What we also learned is that a lot of these other conditions that were being diagnosed by genetic testing that are genetic in nature, so these patients were born with these diseases, could also cause their mitochondria not to function properly in a secondary way, meaning that for unrelated reasons directly to the mitochondria, these patient pathways cause the mitochondria not to function properly. So when we do testing, it looks like their mitochondria is not working properly, but it's not because they have a mitochondrial disease, it's because their underlying disease is affecting their mitochondria for some reason. So we discovered a lot of different things, and we started really trying to make better sense of what the patient might have, because we really needed to make sure that when we put a label on a patient, that label is correct so that the patient can get the proper management and the proper care that they needed. So that's why in the last few years, these new terms came out. So we started saying things like primary mitochondrial disease or mitochondrial disease, which means that we have a patient who presents with symptoms that are consistent with a mitochondrial disease, but in whom we're able to find a gene that confirms that they truly were born with a genetic condition that is affecting that energy production in the mitochondria. And we are now using also a that is called secondary mitochondrial dysfunction or mitochondrial dysfunction, just to make a distinction that these patients may also have a mitochondria that is not working properly, not just related to their energy production, but other things. And that is related to something else that is not related to genes or proteins in the mitochondria itself, but that patient has another process that is going on in their body that is making their mitochondria not work properly. And that's maybe where the confusion came from, because we were using these terms And patients and caregivers and families may not have been very understanding about like why we're doing this. And this is the reason why we have been doing this. So the gold standard now in trying to diagnose someone with mitochondrial disease is really to use the genetic testing. So we have as a first line, when patients come in to see us in the clinic, we of course ask the patient about all their symptoms. We ask them about their family history. We do a physical exam. And then if we highly suspect a mitochondrial disease, we start by this large scale mitochondrial testing. And usually that is enough to find the gene that is causing mitochondrial disease, especially if we have a very high suspicion that the patient has that. And so if we do test, we typically do get to the diagnosis. And if we do get to the diagnosis, then we can do more testing, looking at the metabolic pathway that the mitochondria is involved in to see if there's anything wrong. If we don't find the test, if we don't find the gene on the genetic testing, or if we don't find a change that explains the presentation of the patient, what we then do is we can order more testing. And sometimes we do tissue biopsies. The question comes up all the time about the muscle biopsy. And if we do it, we haven't done much muscle biopsies at all in the last 5 to 10 years because we were able to make the diagnosis just on the basis of the genetics. But in certain cases, we do go back if the genetic testing is finding a change that we cannot really interpret very well to try to get some help through the muscle biopsy, but it remains invasive and we only do it in very few cases where it's absolutely needed. So when we diagnose someone with mitochondrial disease, and because we've been diagnosing more and more patients with genetically confirmed mitochondrial diseases, we can go back now and ask all these very detailed questions about what symptoms look like really in patients who have a genetically confirmed mitochondrial disease. And this table here is out of a study that was done at CHOP. And what they looked at was about 290 patients in their group of patients with mitochondrial disease. And they saw that patient reported having so many symptoms ranging from muscle weakness to fatigue. And the black bars show you how many of these 290 patients have that symptom that is listed here. And as you can see, muscle weakness and chronic fatigue are really at the top. And this has been very reproducible in terms of all the studies that we have done, myself and others. Chronic fatigue and weak muscle weakness and muscle complaints are really at the top of what the patient complain about when they have a mitochondrial disease. But what was interesting is that in the CHOP study, on average, every patient with mitochondrial disease had complained about having more than 10 symptoms at one time. And so they had so many problems going on at the same time that they had this very long list of symptoms. And that was very important for us to know. And that goes back to why patient might be misdiagnosed initially with things like psychiatric disorders or chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. This here, again, I am pointing to a study that we have done asking patients what were their first diagnoses before they were diagnosed with mitochondrial disease. And these are all the diagnoses that were reported by the patient in our study. So you see here, fibromyalgia is at the top, chronic fatigue syndrome is at the top, multiple sclerosis is here. So why is that? Why do they get diagnosed with these things? Well, one thing to think about is that when someone has mitochondrial disease, they don't present right away with more than 10 symptoms at once, right? So they start developing one symptom, then another. So when they start developing these symptoms, they will, depending on the symptom, will go to their primary care or to a specialist. And those will look at the most common reasons as to why patients might have this. And then as symptoms evolve and more symptoms present, you would technically go to a different specialist for each of these symptoms. And it's very hard. It becomes hard when you have many doctors and many visit for the one person along the way to come to step back and say, okay, let me look at this in a big picture frame. And let me see if I can put all these symptoms together to understand whether there could be one disease that explains it all. So there aren't too many places where you could do that just because of the way the healthcare system is. And because, let's face it, mitochondrial diseases are new on the big scheme of the diseases, the disease list that doctors are aware of and are used to. Medical schools don't always teach about mitochondrial disease. So a lot of the doctors graduate without even hearing about what mitochondrial diseases are. And this is not specific to mitochondrial disease. A lot of the rare diseases and genetic condition are so, so rare. There may be a line in one of the books in medical school, and people usually browse through that and are like, oh, I will never see this. This is so rare. I will never see it. So they might not be aware. The initial symptoms might be nonspecific and vague, like you saw fatigue is one of the symptoms. So if you go to the doctor with fatigue, they might not think about a very rare condition initially. And awareness in general plays really a big role. So in the same study here, we asked patients who was the first doctor they went to when they had their initial symptom. Most patients went to see their primary care, right? So your primary care would only probably look at the most common condition. So this list represents the most common condition that your doctors would think about straight away. And then only a few patients went to a subspecialist. And this is because maybe the first symptoms that started affected the eye. So they went to the eye doctor, or it might have affected your liver or the kidney. So they went to saw the subspecialist. And then from that initial visit, only about 12% got a diagnosis, right? So the majority of people never got a diagnosis initially, and they had to go to many more doctors. On average, there were anywhere between 2 to 10 doctors that were seen, and the subspecialists that were seen after the initial visits included neurologists, clinical geneticists, metabolic disease specialists, neuromuscular specialists. So these are typically the subspecialties that know mitochondrial diseases well enough to think about them, to test for them, and to diagnose them. So most patients were diagnosed by this green column here, represented by all these subspecialists. And only then, and like, look at this odyssey, like this is time, right? So from the time the first symptom starts to the time where patients, even if, after they get diagnosed with mitochondrial disease, to see a mitochondrial disease specialist remains low. So only 50% of patients after being diagnosed with mitochondrial disease were able to see a mitochondrial disease specialist. And that's because we don't have as many of them, and they are all very, very busy and very overbooked. And that's a problem that we have to work on. And that's why we need advocacy group like MitoAction to really help spread the word and help educate people and doctors and patients and families so that they can become their own advocate and they can try to raise awareness of the disease so more patients can be diagnosed. Okay, so now I'm going to step back a little bit and talk more about fatigue, because I think this is a topic that comes back very often. And so fatigue is a very common symptom. Fatigue is the end result of almost any medical condition that you can think of. So when someone presents with fatigue, there is an extended workup that is usually done by your primary care physician to try to figure out the most common causes of fatigue. So these include things like hormonal changes and metabolic problems and cancers and infections and chronic disease like autoimmune or inflammation or cardiac disease and things like that. And then there are drug-induced fatigue. So a lot of the medication that we get prescribed, they can cause fatigue. And then there are no non-organic causes of fatigue. So things like anxiety and depression and malnutrition and drug addiction, all of these things can cause disease. So when someone has fatigue, usually they go through this process of eliminating all these common causes. And then when none of these common causes happen, then they get a label of the chronic fatigue syndrome and other things. And that's, again, because mitochondrial diseases and rare diseases don't figure in these algorithms yet. They aren't widely spread across teaching books and things that physicians consult to figure out what patients have. And that should change in the future. But what we've noticed also is that patients with fatigue who typically have primarily fatigue as a problem, and fatigue that has been ongoing for many, many years without having had more symptoms develop over years, they tend to cluster together with a series of different conditions, such as fibromyalgia and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and joint hypermobility and dysautonomia. So all of these diseases, I do find cluster in a lot of the adult patients that come through the clinic. And the one major theme across all of them is this profound fatigue that they feel, so profound that they feel like there's definitely something wrong with them. And they often come to because they think that they might have mitochondrial disease. And a lot of the time, these patients also have a lot of other complaints and comorbidities listed, comorbidities or other conditions they were diagnosed with. So things like mitochondrial cytopathy and sick building syndrome and candida infection and multiple chemical sensitivities and so forth and so on. So these all cluster together. And they do cluster together because what we are learning now is that we know about mitochondria creating energy and making ATP, which is the vital energy that our body needs. But what we have learned over the years is that energy production in the mitochondria is the very small subset of what mitochondria does. Mitochondria does a lot of different things, and some are represented here. So it has a role in fatty acids and hormone making and cell death and iron and all sorts of different things that are listed here, and a lot of other different things here in this big box that we don't know yet, that we don't understand yet. So when we talk about mitochondrial diseases, we're only talking about this little square here, these energy disorders. And mitochondria does so much more. And what we are learning is that all of these other functions that the mitochondria does, they are involved one way or another with a lot of what goes on in health in general. And so in the last, since the 80s in the US, there have been 100-time increase in chronic condition, not just in adults, but also in children. And these conditions, some of them are listed here, they tend to have something to do with mitochondria, not because mitochondria initiates the process, but because mitochondria is the bystander that gets affected, that gets hit as a victim in the course of these diseases happening. And when you look at the list of these diseases, you'll recognize things like chronic fatigue syndrome and Lyme disease and chronic pain syndrome and fibromyalgia and other things like autism and ADHD and all of that. And so I think this is where the confusion happens, is that a lot of the time in lay news and on the web and on the news on TV, there's always this amalgam between mitochondria and all these diseases, and there's a confusion that not everything mitochondrial is mitochondrial disease, and not everything that has a mitochondria that is not working properly started with a mitochondria, but it's the opposite. It's what's underlying the disease that is causing the mitochondria not to function. And when that happens, it doesn't often involve the energy pathway, but it involves all these other pathways in the mitochondria. So that is why a lot of the time patients come in thinking that they have a mitochondrial dysfunction or they have a problem with the mitochondria. And in fact, they have, but it's not the same thing that mitochondrial disease patients have, even though they may also have a problem with energy production, but it's not the core of what they have going on. And because of that, there's still this confounding between all these chronic conditions like chronic fatigue and Ehlers-Danlos and fibromyalgia and dysautonomia. And I'm citing these four because these are the top four that are affected in that affect patients in general at high in high numbers and that we see in clinic often. So I wanted to give you a little bit of a review of what these disorders look like and how they can be confused by patient and by providers in the clinic and why that is. So this is chronic fatigue syndrome. And if you look at all the list of all the symptoms that a patient might have, they involve the brain, definitely depression, anxiety, mood problems, cognition, poor concentration, memory loss, impaired speech. So they may look like they are having a stroke or a stroke-like episode, but it's not really a stroke. They have a lot of immune issues. They have fatigue. They have balance problem. They may have seizures, headache, GI problems, motility, bloating, constipation, orthostatic hypotension, lightheadedness, a lot of pain, muscle aches, all of that. Does that sound familiar? And when you go to Ehlers-Danlos hypermobility syndrome, you find a lot of the same. You have confusion, poor concentration, anxiety, headaches, migraine, vision problem, lightheadedness, all of these. I'm not going to read them to all because they are very, very similar between the two. Ehlers-Danlos, in addition, has the joint hypermobility and a lot of joint problem with dislocation and subluxation and tendinitis and pain, more pain in the joints, but it's pretty similar. And then when you go forth with fibromyalgia, the same. You have your central nervous system, the chronic headache, the cognitive impairment, you have the urinary problem, you have the eye problem, you have the joint, the pain, you have the cold symptoms, the multiple chemical sensitivities, and then dysautonomia includes everything that we've talked about. And more so of the cardiovascular, the lightheadedness, the increased heart rate, and all of that. So you can see, like, if a patient has any of these, they have a lot of symptoms, genuine symptoms that are caused by genuine abnormalities in their body. But to the untrained person who doesn't know these conditions very well, they all look the same. They are all complex. They all have had these chronic issues. And if it's complex, and if it's nobody can understand it, it must be mitochondrial, right? And that's why this confusion continues to happen, is because a lot of these symptoms are very similar from one syndrome, from one disease to another. And on paper, they all might look the same, but they are not the same. And at the core of all of this, there might be some mitochondrial problem. But as I said, it's not because it started with the mitochondria. The mitochondria started off okay, but the processes that cause these diseases over time cause the mitochondria to not function as well. And that adds to all these symptoms over time. So what causes these issues that we talked about, the chronic fatigue, the fibromyalgia, the Ehlers-Danlos, the dysautonomia? Some of them overlap, but some of them are very independent, and we don't fully understand what's going on there either. There is a lot more going on in terms of research, especially after COVID, because long COVID, long haul COVID, and all the fatigue post COVID that pushed the National Institute of Health and other funding agencies to put a lot more money into research and focus on this long haul COVID symptom, which are very similar to all what these patients are talking about and presenting with. And that's good news for everyone, because if we advance our knowledge for the COVID, we can apply that to all of these other diseases, including mitochondrial disease, and we can maybe find better cure for patients. So what causes these issues? Well, first of all, a lot of them are immune in nature. So there's inflammation, there's immune dysfunction, and there's immunosuppression sometimes. There's leaky gut syndrome with bacteria translocating and causing more infections in the body. All of that can affect the mitochondria and make it not work properly. There are biological sequelae like oxidative stress, which damages the cells and damages the tissue. There's autoimmunity that develops, and that can cause small fiber neuropathy and mortis autonomia. And all of that causes all of these symptoms that we see in chronic fatigue and all of that. And so it's true that there may be some energy failure from the mitochondria, but that's really a subset of what's going on here and not the big picture and not the main reason why these things are happening. And as I said, that's secondary mitochondrial dysfunction and not the primary problem that is going on. Okay. So now that we talked about that secondary mitochondrial dysfunction and why the overlap exists and how easy we can get confused when we have all these patients, let's go back to mitochondrial diseases. And I think what differentiates the primary mitochondrial disease from the secondary mitochondrial dysfunction is that when you look at the symptoms of patients with primary mitochondrial disease, they are typically bound to develop severe end organ damage from their mitochondrial disease over time. So if you look at the lists here, they affect the same system, but they affect them differently. So whereas you had the cognitive impairment, the stroke-like episodes that are related to blood flow not getting into the brain properly, here you have damage at the organ level and you have epilepsy, you have dementia, you have brain atrophy, the brain is shrinking, you have developmental regression, severe developmental delays, you have your heart getting enlarged and not pumping, you have bad damage when you have mitochondrial disease compared to all these other conditions, which are devastating and so disabling day to day, but they don't always rise to the level where there is end organ damage. The organs are in their structure okay. It's that they don't function well. Whereas in mitochondrial disease, the organ is affected in its structure and in its function, which is the big difference that there is. And these are subtle differences that someone with knowledge in all of the above needs to know to make the difference. And that's the reason, all that I said, that's the reason why in 2019, the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, which I was the president of, with Dr. Parikh and Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Mary Kay Koenig, we published this paper about the diagnosis of possible mitochondrial disease, the existential crisis, is really to explain all of this to the doctors and try to plead them to please, please be diligent when you see patients. Don't put a label of mitochondrial disease if you're not very, very sure of it. And don't stop the diagnostic odyssey when there might be some other underlying disease that could be benefiting from a treatment that is already available. And this box here, this table here, shows all the reasons why we did this. And we tried to explain this process that I was talking to you about. So it's also a lot of psychological burden to put on patients and families to tell them that they have a terminal disease like mitochondrial disease, whereas all the other disorders don't lead to death. Granted, they lead to a very disabling life and quality of life. It's miserable, but they don't kill people the way mitochondrial disease kill people. And that's a pretty bad psychological burden for families to carry. Families and patients make decisions, reproductive decisions, not to have kids because of these reasons, where in fact they don't have the disease at all. There is inappropriate preventative care. And every time anything happens, the doctors would shrug their shoulders and say, maybe like, oh, it's your mitochondrial disease, so I'm not going to look any further. This is just the way mitochondrial diseases are. We also wanted patients to be able to take medication that they needed and not avoid medication that they might fear being toxic for their system when they are not. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes or so, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we make a diagnosis of mitochondrial disease, what happens in general when patients come in for a mitochondrial disease workup. And how do we recognize? A lot of the patient asks about, like, are there red flags? Do I need to know about to tell my doctor so I can get properly diagnosed? So when we see the patient and we ask them about their symptoms and we do the tests and we do the blood work and the brain MRI and all of that, what we're trying to do is pattern recognition. So we know that mitochondrial diseases come in many different flavors, but there are certain syndromes that present very similarly from one patient to another. So these are the syndromes that you might have heard about, like Leigh syndrome and Alpers and Milas and Pearson's. So these have a set of criteria that are very clear. And sometimes when we're talking to the patient and reviewing the medical record, you could tell like, oh, this is definitely Leigh syndrome, or this is really Pearson syndrome. And we just do genetic testing to confirm that, and then we confirm it. So that's the easy part, right? But these syndromes, the way they are listed here, they have very strict criteria. And not anybody who has, for example, neuropathy will have a label of neuropathy, ataxia, and retinitis pigmentosa. They really have to go through the process of filling all the criteria out so that they can get the label. So this should be a stringent process, and not just because one patient has one symptom that can be seen in the syndrome that they will get the name of the syndrome. It doesn't work like that. So if they don't have a recognizable syndrome that can be readily found, what we look for are red flags. When we're listening and when we're examining, we're looking for these red flags that will increase our suspicion that the patient in front of us might truly have a mitochondrial disease and not something else. So this is a list of some of these red flags, and they can be found on the Mitochondrial Medicine Society website if you are interested in sharing this with your doctors so that they can educate themselves. So a lot of these are neurological, obviously. So stroke episodes and stroke-like episodes that are in a non-vascular pattern, meaning they are not your typical stroke that the patient with high blood pressure has, or the patient with atrial fibrillation, which is a heart condition, has. These are really metabolic stroke that can be seen on the brain MRI and that are very unique to mitochondrial disease. There is a part called the basal ganglia in the brain, which is typically affected in patients who have Leigh syndrome, for example. When we see that, that raises our antennas and we think about mitochondrial disease. There are things like cardiomyopathy, which is enlargement of the heart, certain eye diseases like atrophy of the optic nerve or pigments on the retina and so forth and so on. Patient who have droopiness of their eyelid, or they can't move their eyes. This is commonly seen also in patients with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, not because they have a muscle issue in their eye, but because they have super lax skin. And so their skin just droops because it's super lax. So it's not really the same droopiness that you'd see in mitochondrial disease. And that's sometimes very confusing to patient. I get a lot of refers because patients have droopy eyelids, but they are just droopy because they're like an old age person has their eyelids droop. Patients with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome have the same. Okay. So, in the past, we used to, so remember in the clinical era before we had genetic testing, we used to rely a lot on tissue biopsies and functional assay that looked at that electron transport chain and oxidative phosphorylation pathway and biochemical testing. They are still useful, but in much less than they used to be before, because now we have genetic testing. And what we have learned is that these tests actually have a lot of limitations, including they are imperfect. Because as I explained, some patients have mitochondrial dysfunction that is secondary. And if we do these tests, they will come back abnormal, but not because they have a primary mitochondrial disease. It's just because they happen to have a chronic condition or another genetic condition that might affect their mitochondria. A lot of the time, these can be abnormal just because patients are not very physically active. A lot of the common conditions, such as diabetes or heart disease or neurodegenerative condition like Parkinson's and dementia and all of that, can also cause them to be abnormal. So we can really rely on them to say, oh, your test is abnormal. You definitely have mitochondrial disease. It doesn't work like that. And then there are labs that sometimes are not very qualified to doing this, and they over-report that tests are abnormal when in fact they are not. There are challenges in tissue processing. There are things that are being done on different tissues that might not be representative of really what's going on with the mitochondria, like when you do skin versus muscle and things like that. So there are a lot of nuances and a lot of limitations with a lot of these tests. And just because there may be some abnormalities on them, it doesn't mean that someone has a high probability of having a mitochondrial disease, because these can happen in many different scenarios, even in non-genetic conditions, as I said. Some medications can cause them to be abnormal. Some nutrition can cause them to be abnormal. So it's very important to go through the genetic testing piece. And then to conclude, I just wanted to say that despite all of this, and despite our best efforts as clinicians, and despite all the genetic tests that are available, no matter how large they are, a lot of conditions are not genetic in nature, are not what we call Mendelian, and can be multifactorial, meaning that you could have lifelong exposures to different things, infections and other predispositions that cause like a perfect storm in a patient, and they develop symptoms that make no sense. And so not everything ends up having a specific diagnosis to it, which is unfortunate, and it's very frustrating, we understand, to patients and their families, but that's the nature of medicine. We don't have answers to everything, and not everything is caused by one cause. As a matter of fact, I do have patients who have mitochondrial disease, a primary one that is genetically confirmed, but they also have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is another inherited condition. They have both. Or they can have mitochondrial disease and they can have another genetic condition. Lightning strikes twice and three times, even with two or three different genetic conditions running in the same family. Or you could have a primary mitochondrial disease and you could have an infection as well, and you could have Lyme and you can have EDS. I mean, you could have a combination of any of the above. So just because there is one thing, we shouldn't stop looking. We should continue, but we should be very diligent in what we call and how we call it. Okay, so I know that this is too complicated maybe for some of you, and that if you're still having questions, still in doubt, you can always visit the Mitochondrial Care Network website. It's mitonetwork.org on the screen here. These are the clinical care centers that were certified by the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, funded by MitoAction and the UMDF, to help support patients like yourselves on their diagnostic odyssey or being diagnosed. And I know a lot of the time you guys get frustrated because you call and you want to be seen quickly. And we have super long waiting lists. And sometimes we decline to see patients, not because we don't want to see you all. It's just because we have such limited resources. And I speak for all the sites. We are truly want to be able to see everyone, but it's impossible to see everyone. And that's why we need more awareness and more education so that more and more people can be seeing patients all over the United States. And then for your physicians, your doctors, your providers, if they want to learn more and educate themselves, if they are interested, they can always go to the Mitochondrial Medicine Society website, where we have a lot of information. All our publications are available for free on the website. And with that, I will stop and take some questions. And thank you if I, and sorry if I went too fast at some points.
No, it was absolutely amazing. We really, really appreciate you breaking all of this down. Feel free to unstop your or stop sharing your screen, and I'll go ahead and start asking some of these questions. There are a lot of questions that came through, and you mentioned something, and it's related to a question that came through earlier. It was about, you said that sometimes you can have primary mitochondrial disease and something else, Ehlers-Danlos or Lyme's, or and a patient asked, if you have a dual diagnosis like that, how do you know which to treat primarily, and how do you approach that?
So you should treat both. Lyme disease has a very specific protocol that infectious disease doctors know how to prescribe. So you should go through that. And if that's not beneficial, you continue to talk to your infectious disease person. And in parallel, if you have a primary mitochondrial disease, you should talk to your managing physician. You could take your vitamins, your supplements. You can pay attention to your nutrition, your hydration, your sleep hygiene, and all of that. They are not mutually exclusive. You should do both. And unless there is a specific medication that you should take for one disease that is fully contraindicated for the other, there isn't really a specific treatment for mitochondrial disease, like a specific drug or anything that we can prescribe. And everything we do is really tailored to give you a more balanced lifestyle. So you should do both.
This kind of piggybacks on that question a little bit. A patient asked, is it common to get diagnosed with fibromyalgia from your PCP, even though you already have a confirmed mito diagnosis? Also, the PCP is now thinking I have lupus. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Sorry, I think my connection stopped. I missed the first part of the question. Can you please repeat it?
Yes, of course I just deleted it, but what she was asking was, oh dear. If you ask that question, if you can retype it in the chat, it might be helpful because it was specific and I don't want to ask it wrong. So maybe let's come back to that question.
So I just wanted to say, like, I can't answer very specific personal questions because I'm not your treating physician. So I can answer like general questions, not very specific one tailored to your own case.
Absolutely. Okay, so the question is it common to get a diagnosis with fibromyalgia after you already have a diagnosis with mitochondrial disease? Is that something that you commonly see?
I mean, yeah, fibromyalgia is mostly a pain disorder that is probably caused by small fiber neuropathy. And so, yeah, they are not mutually exclusive. You could have both. I think maybe some patients with mitochondrial disease do have small fiber neuropathy affection that causes a fibromyalgia-like presentation. We don't know that. As I said, we don't know a lot. But you could have both, and you should be treated for both.
What is seen most in liver involvement related to mitochondrial disease?
It depends. So there are childhood onset mitochondrial disorders that affect the liver that can cause liver failure very early on that requires liver transplant. So those are the most common liver involvement in mitochondrial diseases. In general, mitochondrial disease doesn't cause like elevated liver enzymes or major liver issues unless you have one of these what we call depletion syndromes that affects the liver specifically.
Can you possibly discuss a little bit the connection between cyclic vomiting syndrome and mitochondrial dysfunction?
Yes, for a while, I think in the early 2000s, cyclic vomiting syndrome was considered to be a mitochondrial disease, but I think the thinking has changed on that. There were patients with cyclic vomiting syndrome that had that biochemical testing that I was talking about, that they were found to have abnormal electron transport chain function, and that's why the label with mitochondrial disease came about. Ultimately, I don't believe it's a mitochondrial disease. It's definitely related to some gastrointestinal problem with motility, and we don't understand why it comes cyclically like that. And we do understand that some patients from Dr. Bowles' work have benefited from coenzyme Q10 administration and carnitine and things like that that are also given in mitochondrial disease. So I think that's where also a lot of the overlap came from. But right now, cyclic vomiting syndrome is not considered to be a mitochondrial disease, and there hasn't been a gene specifically attached to it.
Another patient was curious if TRAP1 is considered secondary or primary mitochondrial disease.
I have to look that up. I cannot say on top of my head.
Okay. Another question that came through was, Do we think that lack of energy at the cellular level is the common thread to many symptoms and other many diagnoses that you outlined today?
I don't think that the lack of energy is at the heart of a lot of these issues. A lot of these issues in my mind are a problem with the autonomic dysfunction and autonomic problem that these patients have, which causes a major impairment of the how the blood flows into the organs. And when the blood doesn't flow properly, there isn't enough oxygen getting into muscles and into the brain and into parts of the body. And that's why these organs get affected and present with the symptoms they present with. I think energy production is a very small subset, and it might be contributing to some of the overall fatigue, maybe, but it's not the major driver of these diseases.
And how do we, this the same patient asked, secondly, does mitochondrial function naturally deteriorate with age? And how does that enter into the conversation that we have about, you know, secondary mitochondrial dysfunction and all of that? How do you kind of sort through those weeds?
Sure. So aging causes mitochondrial dysfunction over time. So over time, mitochondria have a harder time renewing themselves and making themselves anew. And so, and most mitochondria in a specific tissue, like muscles, that doesn't remake itself like other places in the body, accumulate more changes in the mitochondrial DNA. So over time, mitochondria becomes less and less efficient. And as we age, we lose our stamina, we lose our muscle mass, we lose all of those things. Some of these things are preventable by continuing to exercise and eating healthy and all of those things that we tell our patients to do. But definitely, if there is an underlying problem, the fact that the person is aging is going to contribute the normal aging process and their mitochondrial dysfunction. I think there's a lot of focus on this secondary mitochondrial dysfunction because it's not really a disease in itself. It's just a byproduct of other diseases going on. And because there isn't really much that you could do about it, I think it's a wrong focus to have, to really put all your eggs in, like, I have secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, which is driving everything. I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. It's just a secondary problem. It's only affecting a tiny part, at least from the energy perspective. It might be affecting other pathways in the mitochondria, but right now there's nothing tangible to do about it other than eating healthy, hydrating yourself, sleeping well, trying, if you can afford to take some supplements, you could try some of the supplements, but that's the extent of it really. So whether or not it's there, you do all of these things, you're covering all your bases.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to share that because that's super hard, I think, you know, when you have the mitochondrial dysfunction, you want to be able to do something to help. And it's frustrating that it's a symptom that might not be able to be helped in the moment, but you still need to be able to be validated and know that, like, yeah, like what you're feeling is real. It doesn't take away from that, but something else is causing it. A patient asked, can a person who has a mitodysfunction, if they give birth to, can they give birth to someone with a mitochondrial disease, which is different? And the reason that she asked is because she mentioned that her son has a specific mitochondrial disease mutation, but that she doesn't have, but she happens to have mitochondrial dysfunction.
Yeah. You could have mitochondrial dysfunction and give birth to someone who has a mitochondrial disease, because not all mitochondrial diseases are transmittable. There are some mitochondrial diseases that happen by random chance, like a lot of the genetic conditions that we deal with. Sometimes they are inherited, sometimes they just happen in chance. They always have to start with the one person, right? And so we call these de novo conditions. So they happen in the first person who are born with them has not inherited them from anybody. It was just a problem in the processing of the DNA when they were forming as an embryo. So it is possible.
Do you see mitochondrial and FEOD patient patterns of feeling unwell? Let's see. I'm trying to understand that question. Say, do you see, Miss, think a similar pattern in mito and FAOD patients and how they feel unwell? I think that's what they were trying to ask.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. So all the group of metabolic disorders do tend to behave the same under stress. So stress condition causes their diseases to flare, whether it's fatty acid oxidation disorders or mitochondrial disorders, or there are many like organic acidemias and carbohydrate deficient disorders. All of them, they do get worse, and they have these acute dips in their symptoms and their function if they are subjected to stress. And stress can be an infection, can be surgery, can be emotional, can be physical exertion, anything like that. Yes.
Okay, I'm just trying to see. There's still several different questions. I'm gonna ask you one last one. That's a kind of a big question, and then I'm gonna put my email address in the chat box. So if you have a burning question and it wasn't answered today, please don't hesitate to reach out and email me, and hopefully I can help get you some answers to your question today. There are lots of great questions in the chat. The question that this person was asking is if you could talk a little bit about the work that's being done for treatment options and clinical trials. And I know that's a huge question, but if you can just share a little bit about how you guys are working towards treatment options and what that looks like, that would be wonderful. Yeah.
That's a great way to finish the talk. It's a very exciting field to be in, honestly. When I started this 10 years ago, there was one clinical trial for Lee syndrome, and now we're like struggling to enroll patients because we have so many clinical trials open, which is a great problem to have. And that's why we need the community to rally and continue to enroll in these clinical trials. So there is a lot more interest in mitochondrial medicine in general, because of all the things that I said, mitochondrial disease, primary and secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, and how treatment for primary mitochondrial disease can also help secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, and how treatment for secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, such as diabetes and heart disease, can also maybe improve primary mitochondrial disease patients. So there's this cross-pollination between fields and trying to find treatment for mitochondria in general, regardless whether it's a primary or a secondary disease. So that brings more and more people into the field to try to develop these drugs. There's also more money put into these trials. So right now, we primarily have adult mitochondrial disease trials, adult primary mitochondrial disease trial, and they are all looking for patients who are genetically confirmed. And then we are starting to do pediatric trials. We just had a pediatric trial that finished. Unfortunately, it failed to meet its endpoint, but there are many more in the works, and they are international. So it's not just the US, it's everywhere in the whole world. And so it's very, very exciting. And I'm sure you get all the news from MitoAction. So if you're interested, look out for emails announcing these trials and asking for participation. If in doubt, you can always reach out to these clinical trial sites and ask if you would be a good candidate for them. We will always look at your chart and review and see if you are a good candidate, and we can invite you for clinical trial participation.
Well, thank you so much today. We really, really appreciate you, Dr. Kara, explaining this plethora of information. I don't even know how to summarize it because I feel like it just speaks to the heart of so many questions that our community has. And so there are lots of thank yous in the chats, and you can see the hearts coming out. We just really, really appreciate you. So thank you so much for taking the time today. And if you're joining us today, thank you for taking your lunch break or your breakfast hour to come and join us and learn more about the mito world, mitochondrial disease. And again, if you have any questions, feel free to shoot me an email at sharry@mitoaction.org. And also, this is being recorded, so you can come back and review it, because I know sometimes it's hard to absorb all the information at one time, or maybe you want to send it to your clinician or a family member who's trying to better understand mitochondrial disease. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you for having me. Bye, everyone.